This is Fresh Air. Did you ever enjoy a book so much you felt like it was written for you? That's kind of how I felt when I read Nicholson Baker's new book, You and I. The book is about Baker's obsession with the writer John Updike. It's not a traditional literary study. It's Baker's humorous meditation on how his thoughts and his writing have been affected by reading Updike. Anyone who reads a lot is likely to recognize themselves somewhere in the book, and anyone who's been profoundly influenced by someone in their field will recognize the mix of admiration and envy Baker feels as he constantly measures himself against Updike. I first interviewed Baker a couple of years ago after his debut novel came out. I've interviewed Updike about 4 times, and I'll confess it was very entertaining to read about this one-sided relationship between two writers who I've so enjoyed reading and speaking with. Nicholson Baker is in Philadelphia for a reading this evening at Borders Bookshop. Before he reads an excerpt of his new book for us, I'll let him explain what this book is.
Updike is kind of an excuse for the book, or the condensation nucleus around which the digressions in the book can form themselves. It's not a work of standard literary criticism, I don't think. Normally, if you decided you were going to write a book about Updike, the first thing you'd do, I guess, is lunge for the shelf of Updike books and then read them through and decide and come up with all these perky little insights that were new and fresh theories and interconnections. But I only wanted to write about the things in Updike that spontaneously came to mind. I didn't want to write about him in the way that I would think about him when I forced myself to summon him to mind. And I wanted to capture the feeling of the way Updike existed in my mind spatially on the periphery of my attention.
Now, this is a reading I'd like for you to do, and this is about, you've gone to a party at the Atlantic magazine, and you're feeling very awkward there, you're not mingling, and then you come upon writer Tim O'Brien, and it turns out that Tim O'Brien is friends with Updike. As a matter of fact, they're golfing partners. And you're imagining, what would it be like to be a friend of Updike's? What would it be like to be his golfing partner? So this is a part where you muse on literary friendships.
Literary friendship is impossible, it seems. At least, it's impossible for me. Indeed, all male friendships outside of work sometimes seem to be impossible. You look at each other at the restaurant at some point in the conversation, and you know that each of you is thinking, man, this is futile. Why are we here? We're wasting our time. We've nothing to say. We're not involved in some project together that we can bitch about. We can't flirt. We feel like dummies discussing movies or books. We aren't in some moral bind with a woman that we need to confess. We've each said that the other is a genius several times already, and the whole thing is depressing, and the tone is false, and we might as well go home to our wives and children and rent buddy movies like Midnight Run or Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, or the Pope of Greenwich Village, when we need a shot of the old camaraderie. Updike catches some of the false jocularity of reunions in a story about two ex-Harvard Lampoon types in New York, one of whom is angling for a job in the story Who Made Yellow Roses Yellow. And yet, I want to be Updike's friend now. Forget the guardedness. Helen Vendler once asked him in an interview about decorum and propriety and taste in his poetry, and in particular about the sexual poems in a certain collection that seem a trifle indecorous. Updike said in reply that poetry is experienced in private and that life is too short to worry about propriety. His actual words, soaring miles above my ratty paraphrase, are, quote, "I think taste is a social concept and not an artistic one. I'm willing to show good taste if I can in somebody else's living room. But our reading life is too short for a writer to be in any way polite. Since his words enter into another's brain in silence and intimacy, he should be as honest and explicit as we are with ourselves." Unquote. Well, life is too short to worry about a lot of things. Reserve, tact, the advisability of saying in an essay that you are so miserly with your perceptions that you hesitate to imagine yourself golfing with another writer for fear that he would use something you said, and that even so you still want very much to be friends with him. I am friends with Updike. That's what I really feel. I have, as I never had when I was a child, this imaginary friend I've constructed out of sodden, crisscrossing strips of rivalry and gratefulness over an armature of remembered misquotation.
Nicholson Baker reading from his new book, You and I. The U is the letter U, as in Updike. Has Baker spoken to Updike about the book? We'll find out after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Nicholson Baker is my guest. His new book, You and I, is about his obsessive relationship with John Updike. No, I should mention here that, of course, this book is really much more about you than it is about John Updike. And even in the inscription in the front of the book, you quote Cyril Connolly, who says, "It may be us they wish to meet, but it's themselves they want to talk about." You want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I liked the us. I liked in that quotation. I thought it was true. It's certainly true of me in this book, and I liked the you and us somehow. That had to do with Updike. When I met Updike for the first time at a reading he gave in Rochester, what I was doing as the line of book signees gradually diminished in front of me was trying to figure out a way that I could convey to him that I just recently had my first story accepted by The New Yorker. And so the whole effort of my thought was directed towards coming up with a way to tell him some fact about myself. And I mean, that seems to me true of everybody in those book signing lines.
You made some really interesting rules for yourself in writing this book. One of the rules was that you wouldn't go back and reread any Updike or read books that you hadn't read yet. Why was that one of the rules you created?
Because if you reread a writer, that's a very unnatural and distorted mental condition to be in. Normally, when you think about a writer, it's just that you're, say, driving down the highway and you see a particular pattern of raindrops on the screen, on the windshield, and it reminds you perhaps of a passage that you particularly like in a writer. So that when the writer comes to mind, you find, it's just more interesting. And so I didn't want to begin the book in this unnatural state of preparation. I want it to be impoverished, you know, in that famous phrase from Beckett that he started writing in French in order to impoverish himself, in order to lessen the available vocabulary and make it more difficult. I mean, if you have a profusion of ideas about something, there's no way you can ever narrow it down in one book. In my first two books, in The Mezzanine, I wanted to write about corporate life and, you know, date stampers and escalators and all those nice things. So I had to narrow it down to this one sliver of time of a lunch hour in order to get it manageable. And in the second book, I had, again, to narrow it temporally down in writing about domestic life to a single 20-minute interval. And in this one, I wanted to write about how reading really functions in our lives, but that subject seemed enormous and ungraspable. So I narrowed it down to one writer, to the writer that I'd thought about the most.
And also you're dealing with how memory distorts what you've read. Well, in fact, you make a confession. The confession that you make is that you haven't read all of Updike's works. In fact, you spend two pages enumerating how many pages of each of Updike's books you've read. Fewer than 5 pages of Rabbit is Rich in S, fewer than 20 pages of Rogers' Versions, Couples in a Month of Sundays. And then you say to you, well, people are going to say, well, what right do I have to write anything about John Updike when I haven't read absolutely everything he's written? I love the way you confess to that. And you also confess that you remember very little of what you've read after you've read it. I couldn't tell whether you were just saying that for the book or whether that was really true or not.
Well, it is true. I think it's true of us all. But
it's true
the thing,
of me.
the thing that's interesting is what does persist.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this book is, I hope, a kind of case study of memory. It's very embarrassing, or it seemed embarrassing as I was going through afterwards and having to correct in brackets all these quotations that I was fairly confident of. It's one of the things I did was write down, feeling like a good graduate student, on 3x5 cards, all these phrases that I remembered from Updike, and then I liked the idea that I could sift through them and shuffle them and do all these graduate student things with them. But then when I incorporated some of those quotations into the book as they fit into the flow of things, and when I finished the book, went back and checked, I found that in almost every case I'd gotten it wrong, I mean, even the ones that I was surest about. But I was interested in what the micromechanics of the error were. Did I get it? I mean, I got it wrong in that I'd forgotten which story it was in, and what were the things that really persisted? Usually they were phrases, and interestingly enough, they were often phrases not from his fiction, but from his incidental writing, like his essays and book reviews and things. So I wanted to see what I really remembered.
You get very funny in comparing yourself to Updike sometimes. And, you know, he has psoriasis, you have psoriasis. That's something you have in common. But then you get arthritis, too, and you're thinking, well, that shows I'm really deeper than he is, because psoriasis is a superficial condition. Arthritis really goes a lot deeper.
Yes, it's a form of psoriasis, that psoriatic arthritis. And I felt, I really did feel when finally this psoriatic psoriasis condition showed up in my knee and hip joints, that somehow I had some deeper throbbing condition that would prove that maybe he had the superficial involvement of style, but I had something else. I had something more.
Because your writing is so much about following a train of thought and about thinking, and about the thoughts that somebody has, I was wondering if you ever have trouble turning off the thoughts, if it's hard for you to relax and to not really follow something to its extremes.
Well, I think that what I'm doing is describing the way everybody thinks rather than that I have some wild, incredible circus act going on inside. I mean, with this You and I book, I wanted other readers to see themselves in the book. And I'm just assuming that they think this way and that I just happen to have written about it. I mean, sometimes I think that people assume that I'm some kind of description machine, that I kind of pan across the room and my left lobe just, is flying with phrases about everything that crosses my field of vision. But actually, I have maybe one or two interesting ideas a month, or ideas that are interesting to me, that feel matured enough to write down. And so the effort is always is sifting through all this junk and very uninteresting stuff to come up with the things that feel fresh and arrange them.
The next time he's in your town, are you going to go up to his reading or whatever and introduce yourself? Or now do you really have to stay clear of him until he contacts you, if he ever does? Is the ball in his court now?
I don't know. I mean, I think that eventually we'll run into each other, and it'll almost be as if the book maybe didn't happen. There'll be a kind of stately exchange of hellos. I don't know what's going to happen. If he does come to my town, I will definitely go to hear him read and say hello, certainly. I want to be his friend. I mean, I think that, well, actually, my wife and I went to a reading of his in Meadville, Pennsylvania, and I didn't go up to him because I felt that it was a very awkward moment where the book was just in galleys, and I knew from various people that he had read it, but I didn't want to force a reaction from him. I mean, if he wants to keep his distance from the book, I think that that's certainly his privilege, so I just kind of crouched in the audience. And as we were driving away from the reading, my wife said that it really was too bad because in some ways that this book had made it, that Updike was the kind of person that you'd want to be friends with. And this book had made it more difficult to be friends with him rather than easier. And so that might be true. But I think we'll just have to wait and see, you know, how events develop. I think he'll be so sick of this topic that he'll, you know, he'll want to, I don't know what'll happen.
I don't know. I'd be having a hard time holding myself back if I were you. I'd be wanting to call him or have an agent call him or somebody just to see what he was thinking.
Well, yeah, I sent him a copy of the book. But I don't want to, even that was, part of a sort of an agonized decision of, do you want to force the person to write a thank you letter? You know, I mean, all these things that are part of decorum and literary etiquette, like thank you letters, become highly charged in this context because the book is about him, and he has to come up with something, you know, either noncommittal or praising, and I would force him to be praising when he might. I mean, I do say plenty of critical things in there that could easily make him uncomfortable. And I don't want to have to force him to work his way around them if he doesn't want to.
Nicholson Baker, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Nicholson Baker's new book, You and I, is published by Random House. This is Fresh Air.